listening to The Worried Writer, helping you to overcome fear, self-doubt, and procrastination to get the work done. I'm your host, Sarah Painter, and I'm a novelist and self-confessed worried writer. For show notes, resources, and much more, please head to worriedwriter.com. And now, on with the show. Welcome to episode 3 of The Worried Writer. My guest today is best-selling author and creative writing tutor, Julie Cohen. Julie has published 20 books, and last year, Dear Thing was selected for the Richard and Judy Summer Book Club. Julie is really funny, and I had a blast talking to her. I did have a few connection issues with Skype during the interview, which means the quality is not perfect in places, but I really hope you'll forgive that and listen anyway. Julie is a sought-after speaker and workshop leader, so it's a great opportunity to hear her advice. Speaking of advice, I've got a very practical tip for you this week. It's a little bit of specialist equipment which is, I think, a must-have for any writer. It's a kitchen timer. I've been working on rewrites of a story this week, and my usual method of tracking progress, noting word count, just doesn't work very well. I can rewrite or edit for an hour or more and have only added 20 words to my document. Well, that's just miserable, and it really hits my motivation. Instead, when I'm at the editing stage, I use the kitchen timer to work for 20 minutes at a time. While the timer is counting down, I edit for all I'm worth, and when it stops, I stop and take a break. This works well because it gives me something concrete and substantial to record. I like to keep a note of my progress and productivity, so I can give myself a little tick for every 20-minute session, and maybe after 5 ticks, I get a sticker. This is the sort of thing that works well for me, but obviously each to their own. Also, the little breaks in between work sessions are perfect for small, ongoing rewards. So, 5 minutes on Twitter, a cup of tea, a biscuit, reading an article I've been looking forward to looking at. I use a battery-operated digital timer made by Salter. I'm just looking at it now. Yep, it was very cheap, and it's bright turquoise and shaped like an old-fashioned egg timer, so that makes me smile, which is always a bonus. I definitely recommend using a physical timer rather than a web-based one. Firstly, you can combine the timer with switching off your internet, which is vital if you're finding it hard to focus. Secondly, there is something extra rewarding about hitting the off button on a tangible object. It pulls you away from the screen and it makes you far more aware of what you're doing in the moment. For turning off your internet for short periods of time, I recommend a piece of software called Freedom. I'll link to it in the show notes. A timer is also great for when you're trying to develop a writing habit or get back to one after a break. Anytime you're feeling a lot of fear and resistance about writing, I recommend setting a really low bar, say 5 minutes on the timer, and use that for free writing. When those 5 minutes are up, you reward yourself and go about your day knowing that you've achieved your writing goal. As a side note, you can use this technique for pretty much anything you're finding difficult or easy to avoid. I have used the timer technique for cleaning and tidying the house, working on my tax return, and exercising. So do let me know if you try this tip and how it works out for you. And as always, I welcome feedback of any kind on the podcast. If there's something you'd like included or a question you'd like me to tackle, please get in touch at sarah@worriedwriter.com or find me on Twitter at Sarah R. Painter, or use the hashtag Worried Writer. If I choose your question, I'll read it out on the show and credit you. Finally, if you can spare the time to leave me a review or a rating on iTunes, then that would be brilliant. Those are really, really important for the success of the show. Plus, you can hit subscribe while you're there and make sure you never miss an episode. Thank you for listening, and now on with the interview. My guest today is prolific author Julie Cohen. She has 20 books published, has sold over 750,000 copies, and has been translated into 15 languages. Last year, Dear Thing was selected for the Richard and Judy Summer Book Club, and Julie's latest book, Where Love Lies, has been shortlisted for the Romantic Novelists Association 2015 Contemporary Romantic Novel Award. Julie is also an experienced teacher, and she leads workshops for fiction writers all over the UK and the US. Welcome, Julie. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Sarah.
Well, I gave a very brief overview in that introduction, but if you could tell us a little bit more about your work, that would be great.
Sure. I write contemporary women's fiction novels, the sort of book club end of it. But I started out my career writing steamy romance novels for Mills and Boone. so that's how I got started. And my writing has gradually evolved over the years. I've been a full-time writer since 2006.
Gosh, that's a long time. And were you a teacher before you wrote full-time?
Before that, I was secondary school English in a girls' Catholic primary school. Girls' Catholic secondary school.
Okay.
Which is interesting when I was writing the steamy romances.
So what led you to writing steamy romances first?
Do you know what? Now, this is really embarrassing. So I always read Mills and Boone romances because I read everything, absolutely everything. And I always read the Mills and Boone romances, particularly when I was at university, because they were really light and you knew exactly what you were getting. And I was reading a lot of quite heavy literature and they were my escape. So I always loved writing them, reading them. And when I decided I wanted to write, I had absolutely no clue what it was I would want to write because I loved so many different things that I wasn't sure what to do, you know, a horror, a romance, a mystery story or whatever. So I looked at Mills and Boone and I thought, gosh, they're only 50,000 words and they're just about a romance. I mean, how hard can it be? That's stupid. I mean, you're laughing because that is such a stupid way to think. It really was. And so I wrote one and it was rubbish. Oh my God, Sarah, it was so bad. And it was so bad that I didn't even know it was bad because that's what a newbie I was. I thought it was the best thing ever because I had so much fun writing it. It was just, I cracked up and it didn't fit the genre. It had all these random characters in it. It had no plot. It had no conflict. It was utter. And I joined Romantic Novelists Association and sent it to them, and they were very tactful in the way that they pointed out that it was utter rubbish. So but by then I completely got the bug and I was like, I'm going to do this by hook or by crook. And so I wrote another one, which was slightly less rubbish but still rubbish, and then wrote another one that was, I still think it was good, but nobody else thought it was good. And then my fourth one got accepted.
Yay!
Quite a learning curve, actually, for Mills and Boone. I think I did that in about a year and a half. Wrote those four novels. Actually, got them accepted. Got the fourth one accepted, and then yeah, I can't remember your original question now. And it's not that I think people think that every writer has one burning story they want to tell, but it's not true. I think we all have lots of burning stories that we want to tell. Mm-hmm. We just have to pick the right one at the right time to
yes,
write.
That makes sense. I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about your sort of routine and process, because I must admit I'm really quite envious of your productivity. So do you have a sort of typical writing day, or do you keep business hours, or how does it work for you?
At the moment, it's changed. My little boy, moment I work around him, so he goes to school and I try to write from 9 to 3 every day, although in theory that works. In practice it doesn't always work because there's lots of other things going on. An ideal writing day would be he would go to school at 9, would answer my emails till 10, I'd write from 10 to 12, I would go for a nice probably 4 or 5 mile run, have lunch, and then work in the afternoon until 3 and write about 2,000 words. That's like my perfect writing day. That doesn't always happen because of one thing or another. I try to do 1,000 words every day, and I do try to keep from 9 to 3 when he's at school as office hours. And I try to do things like keep up, catch up with emails and do things. I have a writing consultancy business. I do that sort of stuff in the evenings rather than fresh writing day.
That sounds tiring. This is not a very seamless segue at all, but I wanted to go back to the beginning again, talking about your journey into professional writing, and you were telling me about obviously writing the Mills and Boone steamy romances to start with. Mm-hmm. Did you always want to write, or did you find it really difficult to start sending your work off, or were you just very driven about it?
So I always wanted to be a writer. Mm-hmm. I wrote my first novel at age 11, and I always wanted to write, but that sort of went by the wayside when I did my degrees and then started teaching and sort of was dealing with being an adult. Mm-hmm. Once I decided that I wanted to start again, the writing was never the difficult part. Always enjoyed the writing. Well, the writing itself, most of the time, I enjoy. And at the time, I was just writing for pure fun, for amusement. I mean, I had no contract, no deadlines, and I just loved it. And I would write almost every moment I could because I loved the character in the story. As I said, they were rubbish, but I loved them. And I just wrote. But when it came time to send my first manuscript off to a publisher, I was terrified. Uh-huh. I was really, really frightened. And I put it off for ages, sending it off. And sort of procrastinated and did this, did that. And I mean, I was writing for Mills and Boone. At that point, this was before e-publishing, there was only one place to send it. Mm-hmm. And I had to send it in person, and I just couldn't do it. So fortunately, I had quite a few writing buddies by that time who had joined support groups online, and they bullied me into it. And then once I sent the first one off, I then lost my fear of sending things off. And okay. So I would then, for my subsequent manuscripts, before I got an agent, you know, I would send off again and again and again, which is what I always recommend to people, you know, if you're looking for an agent to send it. I would send off 6 queries, and then as they got rejected one by one, which they did, I would then send out another one. So I would always have 6 out there at any given time. So mm-hmm. It just became a routine to send it off.
That's great advice.
Thanks.
And speaking of advice to people at that sort of stage, I know that you're a teacher of creative writing, and you mentioned that you do consultancy work as well. So you have a lot of experience with beginning writers. What advice do you, apart from making it into a routine, as you were just saying, what other advice do you give writers who are feeling very, very anxious about the submission process, or even the process of simply showing their work to somebody else? Like a critique partner, or?
I think what happened to me and what I see with beginning writers is that beginning writers feel that they have to get it right, that they have to write well, and they have to get praise, and they feel that it needs to be right the first time. What beginning writers don't know, which experienced writers do know, is that writing is mostly a process of failing. So you're laughing in recognition, because that's the way it is. In order to write well, you have to fail first. You have to write badly first. You have to get your rejections. Not everybody gets rejections. You know, some people are brilliant and don't have to fail, but
we don't like them.
No, because luckily I know some people who have never failed, and they're really, honestly, very nice people, most of them. Which possibly has something to do with their success. But I personally failed a lot, and I wrote very badly at first. I didn't know I was writing badly. Mm-hmm. I thought I was pretty good. I didn't. I sucked really bad. Oh my God, Sarah, I suck so bad. So, but as you write more and more and more, you realize that you suck so that you can get better, and you get difficult feedback, an honest feedback, so that you can, it can hurt, but then you can take it on board and move on. And I think that's the best and most liberating thing for new writers to know, is that it is okay to fail. And in fact, it is necessary.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think it time and time again, even in every process as well, I don't know what your process is. In fact, I'm going to ask you, are you an outliner or are you a dive in, write a terrible draft like me person?
A sort of mixture of both.
Okay. Uh-huh.
It's changed through the years. I used to be a just dive in and write, but as I've written more complex stories, like the book I just wrote has three alternating storylines with three different people with three plots, and I could never have done that if I hadn't planned it beforehand. It needed to go through. So my brain isn't big enough not to plan. Some people have good brains that go, but I need to have it fairly established what I'm going to do.
But would you still say that whole Anne Lamott's thing of just writing a really, really crappy first draft is another thing about failing, isn't it? It's that kind of, it's okay to suck, and it's okay for every project to suck for a long time.
No, I think a crappy first draft is pretty important because I think if you don't, in my experience and what I've heard from a lot of people, especially beginning writers, is if you feel you have to get perfect on the page, you get stuck and you just can't move on. And I personally, even though I plan my books, I personally don't really ever know what I was planning to say until I get to the last 10 pages or so. And then I'm like, oh my God, that's what this book was about. What I've been doing this whole year, I'm stupid. And I have to
go back.
So I think the crappy first draft, or giving yourself permission to just get it out, discover what's really happening, is really important too. And it can giving yourself permission to do that, and knowing some days you're going to write just to delete it, gives you freedom to sort of step away from that fear that everything has to be right.
Yes, that's so true. That's very reassuring.
We all suck, Sarah.
And I'm going to ask you a really difficult question now. So for writers who are a little bit further on in their sort of career or journey, what advice do you have for dealing with the stresses and the pressures that can go along with publishing? The sort of, there's writing to deadline and so on, but more and choosing which projects to work on. There can be the pressures of the market, whether it's from your agent or from an editor, or just pressures that you put on yourself, perhaps. Or keeping up a creative routine, keeping up the creative energy, because you've been doing this for an impressively long time, and on a regular schedule, releasing very wonderful quality books. And I'm just wondering what your advice would be for someone wanting to emulate that kind of career.
Well, the thing, before you're published, you think that when you're published, everything's going to be great, and that you're not going to fear anymore, and that you know, it's all going to be swimming and your dream has come true. But then pretty much the minute you sign the contract, you realize that actually it's new fear and on a different level, because you're not just worried about your book anymore. You're really worried about your career and your whole life and your whole self image and how other people see you and all those crappy reviews on Amazon and etc. So, and whether you're going to get a new contract and all of that. So fear never goes away, and it changes and adapts according to your situation. And I think that even phenomenally successful writers, when I've spoken to them, they have also said that they still have the fear, that they're still worried about how people will look at their books, and they're still worried that somebody will look at them and think they're a fraud. You know, in fact, I'm pretty sure I heard J.K. Rowling say that she thought people were sure she was a fraud. I mean, everybody feels it, and knowing that everybody feels that way does make you feel better, I think, because a lot of authors, and me included, you mostly talk on social media or whatever, and you're mostly talking about what's going well or the happy things that have happened, the new deals, the new books, it's so great, blah, blah, blah. But actually, underneath, most of us, I think, are seething masses of insecurity and doubt. And unfortunately, most of what we're insecure and doubtful about is things that are actually beyond our control. So things like reviews or new contract, how much money you're going to get, new contracts, what the market's doing, whether your book's going to get into the supermarket, how much it's going to sell, whether they're going to put any marketing budget behind it, blah, 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 blah. These are all the things that keep you awake all night. But in actual fact, these are all things that are way beyond your control, unless you're something where some of these things are in your control. But it's a complete waste of time to worry about. So my mantra has been for the past few years, because I've been through some of those. I mean, I had to worry about money. I've got bad reviews. You know, you have to look at your sales. It's all terrifying. So my mantra is really to just worry about the things you can control. Mm-hmm. It always has to be about the book. And it has to be about the book you're writing now. It has to be about your writing and take control of it. And that, I mean, you can make good choices. You can choose a good agent. You can choose a good publisher. You can, you know, negotiate things. You can do a lot of marketing promotion. These are all good choices, but, and, you know, manage your image. But what you can really control most is the writing. And that is what you have to focus on above anything else. That's easier said than done, but it's the mantra that I keep on saying, just do what you have the power to do, which is to write the best book you can.
No, that's wonderful advice. And it is strangely cheering to hear that you know, that I'm not alone in those sorts of fears, and that I know, speaking to my writer friends, and we share these, which is partly why I wanted to start the podcast, of course. I wanted to share those so people know that they're not alone. And I don't want to sound like a stalker here, but I'm a very amateur knitter. And yes. I believe that you started knitting owls, and I love owls. Yes. So,
listeners, you can't see this, but I am bringing my computer over to show Sarah one of my knitted owls.
I'm so excited. Oh, that's adorable. Oh, it's so cute. Love the owl. But I wanted to ask, do you use a craft for relaxation, or is it part of your creative process, or is it just an owl obsession?
Well, with the owls, it's an obsession. I've moved on now. Now I'm knitting a tea cozy.
Wonderful.
Not shaped like an owl. It's a non-owl project. The knitting does help because it's repetitive, and it does clear your mind. Mm-hmm. I don't think about my writing when I'm knitting, but mm-hmm. it almost resets you.
Okay.
So that helps. Cooking doesn't help so much. I do some drawing and things like that, but what really helps actually the most for writing is running.
Okay.
Running, walking as well. Walking and running really, really help because that clears your mind. But then something about the repetitive nature of it gets me thinking, which I can't do when I knit because I have to count the stitches.
That's the problem I have.
Then I drop it and then it's just down.
Yeah.
Running, you don't have to think at all, especially if you run what I do is the same route up and down the river near my house. Every time I go, and I don't have to think, I just put on music, and usually it clears my mind and gives me ideas.
And do you run every day? Is that part of your writing day?
I'm too decrepit to run every day. But I'm trying to run several times a week.
But you're running at all. I think that's very impressive.
Oh, thank you.
So since, as I mentioned, the title of the podcast is The Worried Writer, so I know we've already talked a little bit about fear and self-doubt, but I was wondering if I could delve in a little further into your personal struggles with writing, if you have any. Do you ever suffer from creative block, or is there a particular part of the process that you find more difficult, or when fear is more likely to strike?
There are two. First one is during the stage of writing a book, and I'm sure other people will mention this to you, or you will recognize it yourself, which is when you get about 40,000 words in and your book suddenly sucks.
Oh yeah.
And it really sucks. It sucks. Can I swear on this podcast?
Oh, of course, go ahead.
Okay. It sucks. My particular phrase for it is it sucks big donkey dicks. And it always happens in time. And then sometimes you'll get, you know, I've written a lot of books now. Sometimes you'll get about 40,000 words and you're like, oh my God, I still like this. It's great. Maybe this book won't suck big donkey dicks. And then sure enough, 10,000 words later,
big donkey dicks. They turn up.
Oh my God. So the suckage point is awful, and it's soul destroying, and you know you've never, this book is rubbish, you can't save it, it never is going to get anywhere, your career is over, you really might as well get a job in Starbucks, it's just so stupid, and you just, it's awful. Now, I'm very lucky in that, first off, I've written more than 20 books, so I recognize this as a normal stage in my process, but I also have friends who also remember this very well. And I have a friend who has kept an email I sent her in something like 2007, where I said all of the things that I've just said to you, how awful my present, blah, blah, blah. I really might as well give up, blah, blah, blah. And every time I dare to mention any time that then my book is rubbish, she sends me this email. She's like, that was 7 years ago, Cohen, sort it out.
That's a good friend.
It's a really good friend. So that's the first fear part, is the suckage point. That's the fear. But then you have all the other the fear moments, you know, when you send it to your agent, your publisher will hate it, or your editor, and your publisher hate it. And then the moment, the couple days before the book comes out is very terrifying indeed. So there's a lot of stages where you can get the fear.
And how do you find revisions? Your revision letter or rewriting yourself?
I've been hugely fortunate that I have never had any revisions that I didn't agree with 100%.
That helps, doesn't it?
I've had, I don't know how many editors I've had in my career, a lot, but I think it's heading to 14 now. But but all of them have been remarkably sensitive, intelligent, really useful. And so I actually relish getting a good revision letter, because I have never found that it has not made my book substantially better.
And do you have a process for attacking your revision letter rewrites? Do you go from the really small things up to the big structural things, or the other way around, or do you not have structural edits, in which case I might have to cry?
Do you know, I haven't had many big structural edits.
That's it, I'm crying.
I'm sorry, Sarah, I'm so incredibly anal. And my books are structured very, very, very carefully before I even begin. So there's only been a few times, and I'm knocking on wood, because it will happen. I'm sure it will happen, but I have never yet had major structural edits. I've had bits where they say, can you add a chapter here, or this is the pacing is here, so you need to cut that back, or, but that's what I said, you know, I might have needed them, I just didn't get them. Structure to me is a really big thing, so I haven't had that. But I have had some fairly large edits, you know, can you remove the subplot, or, you know, these things happening. And so actually process dealing with the revision letter. First thing is, you read the revision letter, and if there's anything that really strikes you to the heart with terror, you scream and shout about it, get really annoyed, say nothing in public, but maybe moan to one or two very close friends who are very discreet. You do that first. If there are really any problems with it, you would contact your agent, but that never happened to me. But mostly sometimes you do need a bit of venting time to deal with that. What she asked me to do, I don't understand. Then usually the time sorts that out, just leaving it for a few days and then going back to it and trying to figure out what's happening. And, you know, your brain will sort of, I think she's right about that. Oh, yeah. She knows what she's doing. So that's, for a tricky one, I recommend time and chocolate. I usually put the letter in front of me, and I go through it point by point. So I'll do the big things first, it might be easy big things that I do first, but I go through it point by point and tick it off. In the past, I haven't done it recently, but in the past I've had to print out the entire manuscript so I could do things like physically cut up the pages or move scenes around and things like that. Color code stuff, because I love doing that. I haven't had to do that for a little while.
You were saying that you're quite structure is very important to you, and you were mentioning that you do outline to a certain extent, as well as diving in, and sometimes you outline a lot. Is this your post-it system for outlining?
Yeah, I'm obsessed. Doing a workshop at Tamsin Murray's Love Writing Day on Saturday, and
The workshop's called Six Uses for Post-it. I do use Post-its because they're really easy. They're temporary, and you can move them around and throw them away very easily. So it's that whole sort of write crap and giving yourself permission to make a mistake. The Post-its are good because if you make a mistake with them, you can just take them away and chuck them in the bin. And then you can add new things in. So I do tend to, and certainly for the past few books, I've thought through the structure very, very carefully, either before I've started. Actually, the past couple of books, certainly before I've started, I've thought through the structure very, very carefully before I begin. Because, well, for a book like Dear Thing, which has two different points of view, which are very conflicting, or two women who want the same baby, and I wanted them both to be sympathetic, I had to think through the balance of that story very, very carefully in order for that to come across. Mm-hmm. Or you're reading Where Love Lies. There's something that happens in Where Love Lies, which I'm sure you haven't got to yet.
I'm guessing. I'm at the stage where I know there's something going on, and I'm guessing a lot about what it's going to be. And I'm so glad that I haven't had it spoiled. Were you worried about the book getting spoiled in reviews?
Well, do you know, I'm actually ambivalent about it because there is something that happens at the end, which is why I had to plan it so carefully, structurally, so not to say. I'm sort of conflicted about that because I like the fact that there aren't spoilers and that a lot of people have said, oh my goodness, I never expected that to happen, or that to be what's the cause of everything. But on the other hand, what happens is so fundamentally a part of everything that happens in the book that I'm sort of wondering if we should have made it a selling point. Because it's one of those books that's very high concept, but only if you can give away the ending.
But I'm really enjoying it. It's absolutely wonderful. Really good. And very emotional. Mm. It's definitely a sort of thump you in the chest, slap you in the face, sort of, which is in a good way. So, sorry about that. To get back to, you were talking about your revision process and about, we were talking about post-it notes, and you were talking about your strategies. You mentioned earlier that just knowing, having been through the process many, many times now, you have that awareness, that's going to happen. I just need to keep going. Yeah. So would that be your main bit of advice to people, to just keep on going through there?
Just keep going. Yeah. Just keep, know that the doubts are normal. Mm-hmm. That knowing that the doubts are normal doesn't make them any easier to deal with when you actually have them, because you wouldn't have them if you didn't think they were true. So, you know, just knowing, yeah, this is the donkey dick stage, doesn't actually, it helps, but not actually that much. I think you have to keep on going. You have to have faith in yourself, faith in the vision that you had when you were putting this book together. I think you need to, obviously learn from advice as much as you can, but still very true to what you want to do with your career and with your stories.
That's very good advice. And are there any particular books or resources that you would recommend for anyone who is struggling with fear?
Yeah. Well, you know, you said Ralph Keyes' The Courage to Write, and that's the one that I used because I thought it's tremendously reassuring, because it just basically tells you how every other writer is just as mad, bonkers, crazy as you are.
Absolutely. Before I read that, I had read a lot of stuff, but it really, I just found that so reassuring. And to also think that some of my anxieties and fears, to say that they're a good thing is maybe stretching the point, but they were maybe a facet of feeling that my skin was too thin, was maybe a facet of being a creative person, and maybe not an entirely bad, maybe part of the reason that I could write at all, as well as being something that made it very difficult.
Yeah,
I
think that's it, that creative people are often very thin-skinned. I also think that, I'm not sure, I think he says this in the book, that being frightened of what you're doing is a sign that you're right, because you're in your comfort zone, and it's only when you push your comfort zone that you get better. Mm-hmm. And I have a very inspirational editor near the beginning of my career who said that to me, because I would just call her. She was the one who took me really from writing shorter sort of romantic comedies to longer, more complex books, and sort of I credit her with moving me from rom-coms to Richard and Judy. And she said to me, she said those very words. She said, if you're scared, that's good, because you're writing on the edge of what you can do.
And we want to keep on learning and improving, don't we? I think that's part of the, I think that's part of the fun and excitement of writing, is that it's scary and there's so much to learn that we're going to be doing this for life, a lifelong learning type thing. We're never going to get to a point when we go, that's it.
Yeah.
Unless you're at that point now that, Richard and Judy.
No.
Is that the point? And you go, that's it. I'm done. I made it.
I'm done now.
I've got it totally sorted.
I think you have to keep on evolving and changing. And the thing is that the market changes. So it's a good commercial thing to do as well. Develop your skills, change, try new things. You have to do it. And I think actually that's one way of dealing with the fear too. I have this story of before Dear Thing, the book before Dear Thing, I was writing for Headline, and I had a great editor there. I really loved her and I was very happy with Headline. Headline did not want the kind of book that I wanted to start writing. They wanted me to keep on writing romantic comedies, which is, fair enough. That's what they wanted. But I wanted to move on. I wanted to get a bit deeper. Dear Thing being the book that was chosen for Richard and Judy. So I was right. Haha. Anyway, I got to a point where I kept on giving them ideas for books, and I kept on saying, no, I don't think that's right. I don't think that's right. I was between contracts. Kept on giving the ideas. Kept on giving them. Said, no, don't think that's good. Don't think that's right. No, that's not quite what we want from you. It's not. I must have come up with 20 or 30 ideas that I was running by my agent. I was running by my editor, and nothing was striking them. And one of them was the idea for Dear Thing, and they just were not, it wasn't striking them. And I was really, really down. I felt that my career was probably over. I probably wasn't going to get another contract. That this was, what was I doing? It was rubbish. And it wasn't that I was rubbish. It was that I was getting very discouraged by this. So what I did, Sarah, and I don't advise this for everybody, but it really did work for me, was that I just decided, yeah, screw it. I'm going to write something only to please myself. I'm not going to worry about a contract. I'm not even going to worry about getting published. I'm going to write just the stupidest thing I can think of and amuse myself, because I need to have some fun. So I wrote an erotic science fiction romantic comedy novella about a woman who falls in love with a blue robot who was basically built like a Ken doll. And it was called Love Machine. And I had most fun writing that, happy thing, in years. I laughed the entire time. I just laughed. It was just brilliant. And something about writing that blue robot, even though I wasn't even writing it for publication at that point, just loosened me up. And I just felt, I can actually do this. It's really stupid. Why am I working? It'll work out. I just need to keep on working and something will happen. After I wrote that blue robot, we decided to then pitch their thing to other publishers. And within a couple of months of getting that blue robot story, I think I had 4 publishing deal offers.
Wow.
On the table. I could only, 2 of them were for the blue robot. And 2 of them were for more mainstream books. And so it just gave me my mojo back, gave me the courage to keep on trying, to, get serious, to decide what I really wanted to do, whereas, as opposed to what my publishers wanted me to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, so there's my advice.
Blue robot. You heard it. Yeah, you heard it here first. Write a blue robot.
But well, you might want to write, like a silver one.
But it must have been very scary, because knowing that you had a publisher who wanted work from you, you know, that's great, that's your job. Yeah. But you want to be doing something a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And it must have been very, I think it's tremendously brave, it must have been very hard to resist the call of simply going, okay, they want another romantic comedy. Did you consider that? Did you think, oh, okay, I'll just write another romantic comedy? That's...
Yeah, I kept that option open right up to the last, when I found out that I was getting a contract for Dear Thing. I mean, because I...
Sensible.
It would have been fine. Mm. I'm... After a lot of books and writing in many genres, I'm not necessarily really precious about what I write. I am extremely lucky at this point right now in my career to be able to write exactly the kind of books that I want to. Mm-hmm. But I know that that is a luxury for most writers, and that if in the future it may well be that I have to adapt and change what I write and go back to writing something very, very commercial and light, or maybe completely change genre or something like that. I've realized that for me, it's the writing that's important, not necessarily this brand that I'm writing in now.
Yes. But I'm absolutely cheering that you got your mojo back, and that this book that you wrote, Dear Thing, that you really loved and wanted to write and believed in, was then such a huge success. So that must be so gratifying. And it's also encouraging to think that sometimes you can follow your passion in this business, which is great.
You should. You know, whenever you can, I think you should follow your passion.
That's brilliant. I've got the question written down that I wanted to ask your tips for a long-term writing career, but I think you might have just hit some there. I was going to mention that you've also written in different genres, as you just mentioned. And you also draw, or have drawn, Sherlock Holmes cartoons, I believe, for the Sherlock Holmes Society's journal. I was going to ask, is creating different things part of your sort of long-term strategy for staying sane and happy?
Yeah, is it a strategy, or is it just sort of random obsessions where I just have to do these things? I think it's... But, you know, I have always been a fangirl. I'm a real fangirl, and being a fangirl, all the best people are, you know, and being a fangirl makes me very happy. So it's really a strategy for my long-term happiness, is to do the things that make me happy. And in my case, they're often creative things, because I think once you get into a creative habit, then you just keep on doing it. So writers are amongst the only people I know who, when they have a bit of time off writing, just do a little bit of more writing for fun, which I do all the time. So I write just stuff for my own gratification that will never make any money for me. And I just write it because it makes me happy. So I think you have to do things that, and then sometimes the things that make you happy then can lead to things that make you money. So the Sherlock Holmes cartoons led, I've sold a short story to an anthology. I was commissioned to do that. So it can lead to other things. I think if you're passionate about stuff, and that passion is through.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's brilliant. Well, I don't want to keep you too long. So I was going to wrap up by saying thank you so much. And also to wanted to know, where would listeners go? Where's the best place for them to go to find out more about you and your books?
My website is www.julie-cohen.com, or you can just put Julie Cohen into Google, and I think I'm top at the moment. You can also find me on Twitter almost every hour of the day, which is wrong, but there it is. And there I'm Julie_Cohen.
Okay, that's brilliant. And your latest book is Where Love Lies, which, as I said, I'm thoroughly enjoying. I definitely recommend. I will put all links in the show notes, and also teaching events. All details of teaching events are on your website, I assume?
They are all on my website. I'm doing two residential courses this summer, one in France and one in Wales. I'm not sure when your podcast is going to be up in time for that. But then I have lots of other ones, and they're on my website as well.
That's exciting. And do you enjoy the teaching?
I love it. Mm-hmm. It's really rewarding. And especially with the sort of courses I'm lucky enough to teach, which have writers who are have a certain amount of experience. So I've seen so many people who have been on my course get publishing deals, and it just feels wonderful. It's not down to me. It's because of them. But, you know, I got to touch them.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you again so much for your time. It's been really lovely to speak to you. And yes, good luck with your next book.
Thank you. Good luck with yours.
Thank you. Thanks for listening today. For show notes and links, head to worriedwriter.com. If you'd like to connect, find me on Twitter at Sarah R. Painter, or use the hashtag worriedwriter. See you next time.